in right here at this meeting tonight. So, guys, I would like you to warmly welcome Cindy M. from Kentucky. Thank you.
Thanks, Jim. My name's Cindy Masters, and I'm an alcoholic. And because of the grace of God, some simple actions in this program and both sides of sponsorship, I've been sober every single day in a row since December the 17th, 1985. And for that, I'm very grateful. It's really the biggest deal in my life, and it remains the biggest deal in my life. And because of that, I have a pretty incredible life. It's always unusual when you visit different places. It's the same, but it's different. Our traditions are different. And, you know, I like the readings that you read. They're not typical. Especially like page 30, because it is where it says we can see to our innermost self that we're alcoholic. This is the first step in recovery. And you notice that's 30 pages in. And so for me, to get all the way there, I originally got here in 1980. And I got here very defeated, but not surrendered. And they're different. I got here defeated because I had a whole lot of consequences and I was beat to death by the streets and drinking. But it took 5 years of trying in Alcoholics Anonymous, being around in Alcoholics Anonymous, to finally surrender to my innermost self that I'm an alcoholic. And for me, what the difference is that when I surrendered, I know that no matter what changes in my life or what changes in me, I can never drink successfully. No matter what, when I put one in me, I am never going to be able to predict what's going to happen after that, other than there's a really, really good chance I'm going to want more, and I'm not going to know where that's going to take me. I can't predict, and I can't tell you. And so for me, that was my surrender, and it took me a while to get there. As I said, I originally got here in 1980. I was very young. I was only 17 years old, and at that time, gosh, I had already been in a couple dozen institutions. I had hitchhiked from one end of this country to the other. Essentially, I spent all of my adolescence and teenage years either locked up or on the streets. And my life was everything that goes along with that. Drinking, I really thought, was my friend. I started drinking when I was very, very young, and I drank for exactly what it talks about in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I drank for the effect produced by alcohol. And what that meant to me is different than what I hear some people talk about. It didn't make me feel taller. It didn't make me feel smarter. It didn't make me feel more beautiful. It didn't do any of that for me. I felt like I was bleeding from the inside out. I really saw myself and my life as I was just a victim, and I just hurt, and I didn't know what to do with that. And when I drank, I hurt less. It cauterized the internal bleeding. The problem is that as my drinking progressed, it began to be the cause of my problems, but I couldn't see it. I could only associate it with being what made me feel better, even though by this time it completely had backfired on me. When I got here in October of 1980, I'd been living in D.C. on the streets. I stayed in touch with only one set of people. It was a foster home I lived in. And I really didn't care about anything or anybody, including myself, anymore. I didn't have a hope. I didn't have a dream. I didn't have nothing I was going to be. I didn't go to high school. You know, what kind of life could I even have? I was already blotting it out to the bitter end. But my foster brother and sister had muscular dystrophy, and I cared about them. When I was there, it probably saved my life. It was the first place that I ever met anybody that I felt life was less fair to than me. They'd never been able to walk. They couldn't take a bath. And it was also the first place that I ever felt like I mattered, because I could help put the kids to bed. I could do things like that. And usually, if you've been in foster homes, that kind of thing, usually it's not a very pleasant experience. But for me, this one was. And I loved them. And I loved being there. And my foster mom, she knew I was an alcoholic. She's the first person that told me I was one. I was 14 when I lived there. And she had one rule for me. I was not allowed to drink until the kids were in bed. And as much as I wanted to stay there, I couldn't. My alcoholism had already owned me. So I could not keep a commitment about drinking. And that's pretty pitiful by 14. So fast forward 3 years, the only people I stay in touch with, my foster brother's having a surgery. I hitchhiked back to Cincinnati, which was home base from Washington, D.C. And he survived, and I did exactly what I would have done, whether he survived or whether he died, because whatever happens in my life, here's what it calls for a cocktail. You know, if they die, I call it grieving. If they live, I call it celebrating. But no matter what, I'm going to have a cocktail. And for me, I am a blackout drinker. And what that means is I can wake up dead in the middle of a conversation and not know where we're at and have to catch up. You know, I can wake up in very terrifying, scary places and not know how I got there and not know whether I'm safe. And I can wake up in really safe places and not know the same. So on this particular night, I'm almost always a blackout drinker. I also carried a gun. And I carried a gun because I didn't have a whole lot of voice. And this was pretty unusual in 1980. It's not like it is now. But I found that if I brought that gun out, people paid more attention to what I had to say. So apparently I'm drunk in a blackout, and I run into this retail store chasing my friend down. Even though I wasn't there to really steal anything, they called the police. I wrestled with the police. This is all related to me. I was in a complete blackout. What I remember is I woke up hanging on a cinder block wall, tied down from my chin to my knees with the stretcher hanging on the wall, black and blue from where the cops had beat me with billy clubs. Thank God, because they probably should have shot me. And I wake up and I look and I'm like, who did this to me? Because all I can ever see is what a victim I am. I can never see how I set the ball in motion. Everything is just what has happened to me. Who did what to me? Why nobody's ever given me a chance? I'm so angry. And the nurse looked at me. She said, you did. And here comes a second person that tells me I'm an alcoholic. She said, you're an alcoholic. And then she said that the sheriff was on his way to get me. I had 7 felonies. And I was not going to juvenile, even though I was barely 17. They were taking me to county jail, which is called a workhouse in Cincinnati. I had fried the system. You know, I have 2 brothers that hardly ever got caught, and I used to resent them so much because I always get caught. And when I get caught, I go someplace, and every time there's somebody there that wants to help me. You know, there's always been, like, people don't go work at those places because they don't care at all. There's at least one person that cares. And overarchingly, most people do want to help, but I was so angry I couldn't accept it. And so I had hurt your opportunity to get help when you were there. So I was a disruptor, and so I was no longer welcome in the juvenile system. My good news is I went to county jail, and I had been beaten by the streets, the cops, by my alcoholism, and I went into pretty serious withdrawal. I started having seizures in the cell, and that was my good news. Because, see, every time something bad happens or I get caught again, I give a chance. And somehow by doing that, I wound up back in University Hospital, and then I somehow got to go to treatment. And that was my introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. And really, the highlight of treatment would be this, because I didn't relate to anybody there. I'm there with a bunch of old men. You could not have put together a complete set of teeth from all of them. And, you know, I'm 17. I've still got, you know, I'm full of piss and vinegar, and I think I'm hot, and I think I'm a badass from the streets, and I'm disrupted there, too. But what did happen there, the memorable thing for me, is that after a few weeks, they made me go to A of A. And I wasn't about A of A. I wasn't about being with these old men. I wasn't about, they didn't get me. They didn't get where I came from. You know, I didn't think I was going to live another year in the way I was living. I shouldn't have. So, but what I do remember is that they were really nice to me, even though I was a punk. You know, I would use my terrible vocabulary to push them away. And all I wanted was for somebody to love me, but you were going to have to prove it really hard. And so I just sabotaged everything. But what I do remember is that they said, Cindy, if you'll just work those steps, your life can be different. And I said to them, and I meant it with everything inside of me, I said, I wish that could be true. I wish that could be true. But see, you don't understand. I'm broken. And I meant it with everything inside of me. See, all those places I ever was, they gave me little labels. And I had internalized those, and I made that my identity. You know, I was discardable, I was throwaway, and your little 12 steps and alcoholism were not going to fix my life. So I didn't try them, because I thought if I try them and they don't work, it'll prove what everybody's ever said about me right. It'll prove that I should be discardable, that I am so broken. And so I hung out in AA. And I used people in AA the same way I used people on the streets, because it's what I knew. I didn't go about using people. It's just all that I knew to do. I slept on your couches. I got you to buy me food. I got you to give me money. I got you to buy my coffee. And I used people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then I found a couple fellas, and I went out, and we did a robbery. And because that's what I do. When I go out and I drink, I get bigger than the rules, and I always get in trouble. And while that sounds terrible, it is my good news. Because at this point, even though I've been around AA 6 months, I'm still 17 years old. And I get arrested in a new county. My probation officer had been a detox nurse for 10 years before. And so once again, my failure created an opportunity. Once again, you know, my anger, all the things that I was doing created an opportunity for me to get sober. You know, it's pretty evident in the rearview mirror that God was giving me a lot of chance. There was no halfway houses for women in Ohio or Indiana. They had just opened one in Lexington, Kentucky, and they sent me there. And really, the highlight reel of what happened there was that three things I learned. I learned that you can't change the way you feel to change the way you act. You can't change the way you think to change the way you act. I'd always been waiting for one of those places, the right shrink, the right anything, you know, to help me feel different so I could act the way those people look like they act. And what I learned there is the first thing that they did was made me go to meetings early and help make coffee in this place that I didn't think I deserved to be and I didn't think I belonged. All of a sudden, you guys started to know my name, and I started to feel like I belonged in AA. So I learned that by changing my feet, I changed the way I feel. Then they said, Cindy, you need to get a J-O-B. Well, I don't have a driver's license. There's never been anybody to sign for one for me. What kind of job am I going to qualify for? I don't even have an identification. And you can imagine what my work history looks like. So I got a job setting tobacco in the fields, which is very hard work. And it changed my life, because what happened was, by going out making my own money, I stopped manipulating you to buy me cake afterwards. I stopped manipulating you, and my shoulders started to go back, and my chin started to go up, because I was paying my own way. Something about becoming self-supporting changes a lot of things. And then they said, Cindy, we want you to go take these tests and see about taking these classes to get your GED. I said, GED, man, that's for losers. That's for people that didn't go to high school. Now, I didn't go to high school, but I think if I don't get a GED, this is my magical, magnificent mind, you know? If I don't get a GED, you don't know I didn't go to high school. I mean, it's just, it doesn't make any sense. So I went to take the test because they didn't care how I felt. They didn't. They cared what I did. And I went to take that test, and I took the test. I didn't have to take any classes. I took my GED, and I scored in the top 2% of anybody that had taken it at that time. So this thing that just a day before was like, I don't want to take that, that's for losers, all of a sudden it becomes, look at me, I'm Cindy, I got a GED. And so I'm proud of it. It's like, that's how I've been with a lot of my life. If I think you're not going to like me, I just don't like you first, you know, because I'm afraid to be vulnerable. I'm afraid. I don't know what I'm acting with all this bravado, but inside I'm just afraid. So I went back to Cincinnati. It was an AA Wonder Girl. Really groovy stuff happened. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. There is nothing better that's ever happened in my entire life. And I have an amazing life. But Alcoholics Anonymous was the first place I ever felt loved. It was the first place that I ever felt like I belonged. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And so when you have a really low bottom, you know, people seeing you as a success isn't hard, because all you've got to do is start speaking in complete sentences and people are like, yay, you know what I mean? It's like, you don't have to do something great. You just have to be and participate. So I stayed sober a couple years. I made some amends. Weird fluke of events, I ended up with a job I had no business in through making amends. And my ego took the job. I got offered the job of the executive director for the outlying counties for the Muscular Dystrophy Association, and it was a fluke. I had no business in it. I was the youngest person they'd ever hired for that position. There's one in each city in the country, and I was the only person without a college degree. So the minute I took the job, I thought, when they find out who I am, they're not going to keep me. So I immediately get full of fear. But my ego, see, I have to be more to be enough. I never think I'm better than you. ever. But I think I need a little better car so it's good enough for you to ride in. I need a little bigger house so it's good enough for you to come in. You know, I always think I need more to be enough. It's my manifestation of my egomania with my inferiority complex, right? And I took that job and I thought, now I'm good enough to talk to you about business or money. But I would go to that job and I would be afraid, and I would go to AA and I would tell you how great it was. And I would tell you, if you work the steps, you too can have a job like this. So what I'm doing is I'm living a double life sober. Just like it talks about in the fifth step of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm playing Let's Pretend in AA. I'm not coming to you and telling you I'm afraid, I don't know how to do this job, I know they're going to figure out who I am, and had I done that, I probably would have had a different experience. Instead, I'm coming and telling you how great it is, and I'm going to that job, and I'm hiding from my secretary because I don't know what you do with the secretary, and I'm waiting for them to figure out who I really am. And this went on for almost a year. I turned 3 years sober, and next thing I know, I'm drunk. I woke up drunk. I don't remember taking a drink. I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous. You can get drunk going to Alcoholics Anonymous if we're not honest and we're not doing the deal. You know, meetings alone won't save us. Only a spiritual experience. Meetings helped reinforce that for me. But I got drunk and I was relieved because I had an excuse not to go to that job. I didn't know I could quit something that I thought made me look good. I didn't know that I could tell you I wasn't ready. I drank and I didn't have to go back, and I came back to AA and I'm like, I'm ready to be sober. And I raised my hand at that meeting, and I left that meeting and I drank. Because what I didn't count on was the phenomenon of craving that it talks about in the doctor's opinion that happens once I put one in me. You know, once I put one in me, I don't get a very much choice about drinking, because I get a phenomenon of craving and a mental obsession that just take over and it's on. And so for almost a year, I tried to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And for almost a year, by the end, I didn't try to come back so much. By the end, my drinking life had become normal, but with none of the bravado. There was no jails. There was no threat of prison. There was none of that. I was a garden variety alcoholic. You know, I lost where I lived. I'd live with you. You know, I had a car repossessed. I think that's the worst thing that happened. But I'm somebody that when I drink, I can't tell you what's going to happen. I can't tell you how much I'm going to put in me, and I can't tell you how I'm going to behave. And I tend to throw up, and I tend to lose my bodily functions when I get drunk enough. So my last drunk was December the 16th, 1985. And it's pitiful, and it's incomprehensible, and it was the demoralization I needed to finally surrender. And what happened for me was I was coming out of a blackout, and I've already told you how scary that is. I'm coming out of a blackout. I don't know where I am. I don't know if I'm safe. I don't know if I'm not safe, and I'm terrified, and I am crying. This badass from the streets is just crying. And I'm crying because I don't know where I am. And then when I finally come out of this blackout and I figure it out, I'm sitting right in front of where I live. I've urinated it on myself. I have puked on myself. I'm sitting in front of the place I live crying because I can't figure out how to get home. It's just no more pitiful than that at all. Again, no bravado, no big war stories, none of that. Just garden variety, gross alcoholism. And the reason why I even describe it at all is because alcoholism is gross. At the end of the day, none of us get here because we feel good about ourselves drinking or because we carry ourselves well drinking. We come here because it kicks our behind. And at that point, I finally had what it says on page 30. I knew it could never be different. And the next morning, I said words that never fail an alcoholic. I said to a God I don't believe in, that I didn't believe would really help me, that I couldn't define. I said, please help me. And I've never heard that fail any of us. And then I got a sponsor who didn't know near as much about AA as me, because I knew about the Washingtonians. I knew about the Oxford group. I memorized Alcoholics Anonymous. I had almost a photographic memory, and I would use it as a weapon in meetings when old timers would misquote it. Boom, boom, Mr. Old Timer, you're wrong. That page doesn't say that. And, you know, very popular I was, not. See, I always have to be more to be enough. I have to know it so I can be enough. And I use that to elevate me in meetings because I didn't know it. And so I picked a sponsor that knew how to stay sober and knew how to put those steps on her life. And the first thing she said is, Cindy, you may not quote the big book anymore. You can only paraphrase as it applies in your life. I didn't know what that meant. I don't know how to do that. The next thing she said is, I want you to look at the probable consequences if you drink again. Well, that's easy. What do we all say? I'll go to jail. I'll go to a mental hospital. I'll die. She laughed at me. She said, you're not afraid of none of that. And she's right. See, I grew up in jail. I do great in jail. You know, I'm practically like vice president. And I was in mental hospitals like the state mental hospitals in the 70s. And if you just manage to take more pudding than your fair share, you're a success there. The bar is so low, it is not hard to be queen. It's just not. And that's like the next adventure. I've ridden a Harley Davidson my entire recovery. That is not somebody that's afraid of dying. It's just not. So she made me dig deep, and I'm so grateful for this. She said, and what I came back to her with was that the worst thing that can happen is I drink and I don't die. Because, see, when I drink, I become a black hole. I have no moral compass. I will suck the life out of you, telling myself I love you. I'll promise I'm going to show up for that baseball game, but I won't because I can't, because a drink and my self-centeredness are going to come between me and you every time. And I don't want to live 20 years like that. I don't want my legacy to be I hurt people my whole life and I used people that tried to love me. I don't want that to be my legacy. I still don't. You know, I'm 34 and a half years sober and I work my tail off in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'm right in the center and it's harder now because I have tremendous success. And so it's much harder to be in meetings all the time, to stay up till 10 o'clock to give a talk in California when I got to get up and run my business first thing in the morning. You know, but Alcoholics Anonymous comes first, and that's why I got a life. Now, the real deal is, you know, how do we live sober? How do we put this thing on our life? You know, we all know how to drink unsuccessfully. And most of us know something about getting through the steps at least once. But what does that look like when life starts happening, when life on life's terms start happening? So for me, there's like about five stories I'll tell, and I'll tell them as quick as I can. So the first thing that devastated me was my grandmother died. And I was 11 years sober, and it broke my heart a million ways to Sunday. And the reason is my grandma was that one person who was consistent in my life. My background did not, there was nobody consistent. People loved me, but they just couldn't do it every day. My grandmother always loved me, and she taught me about God, and she taught me about people. My grandmother had love and tolerance. She never uttered a negative word about anybody or any group of people, and she grew up in an era where that was popular. She went to church all the time and never scared me. You know, she just said, Cindy, God loves you, period. And she made it feel believable. And when I was in my 20s sober, I would go visit her and she would wash my face before I went to bed. And I'd snuggle up with her. And that was the only person I could be that intimate with. And so she taught me that fear and faith are always inside of us. You know, I used to come to AA and they said you can't have fear and faith at the same time. And that is not true because they are both core emotions. And what she taught me is which one I feed is the one that wins. I always have fear and I always have faith. If I feed fear, I'm going to be negative, I'm going to be cynical, I'm going to gossip, I'm going to be less than kind. If I feed faith, I'm going to be kind, I'm going to be loving to you and even me. So what the problem was, she was 83. What was the problem when she died was that she was scared. And I got so mad at God. I'm like, how can you take this little lady that served you her whole life and let her be terrified to come meet you? And I took a walk in the dark sober. And I think if you stay sober long enough, all of us will at some point. And I just couldn't connect with God, and I didn't believe that God was anything I wanted anything to do with anymore. I thought he was a fraud, that he took this little lady and let her be that scared. And so I did two things right. See, we have to partner with God. I've had a lot of grace extended to me because I don't do any of this perfect. But what I did do was I went to meetings and I told the truth. I didn't go to meetings with my 11-year sober personality and tell you everything was okay. I went to meetings and I cried and I said, I can't feel God. Because once you've had a spiritual experience, it is very lonely to lose that. And I'm mad and I would be honest. Because see, we must have the capacity to be honest if we want to stay sober. To me, what that means is that I'm transparent and I'm authentic. It means that I'm the same person with you tonight that I'll be with my employees tomorrow. It means that I'm the same person with you tonight that I am here in my home. That takes a lot of work, and I don't do that perfect, but I certainly want to, and I try to. So I was honest, and the other thing I did was I didn't quit looking for God. I was open to that if God would show up, it would be all right. So February 1, 1998, I've turned 12 years sober that December. This has been going on since that last July. I told you, I've been riding a Harley my whole sobriety. And, you know, they wanted me to meditate. Well, I vibrated a lot, you know, and like, I don't have this committee. I got a firing squad. Mom, you piece of junk. You know, you don't belong here. What's the matter with you? You know, it doesn't shut up. It doesn't leave me alone. So meditation would be like purgatory for me. So I bought a Harley Davidson and it vibrated more than I did. And it was louder than all those voices in my head. And I could feel God in the wind. Because my experience is that if I want to meet God, all I got to do is want him. God will show up where I am. I don't have to go to his building or his mountaintop. I don't have to do any of that. I just have to want to meet God and he'll show up. So my Harley was my first meditation tool. So February 1, I get on it. I get on Interstate 65. We've got all the big highways crossing the country right here. And I'm on there maybe 10 minutes. I'm doing somewhere between 65 and 70 miles an hour. And the next thing I know, kaboom, I'm hit. And according to the police report, I was catapulted 17 foot in the air. I came down the center lane of the highway. Somebody's driving. Plop, there I am on their hood. I rolled off that car, and that car drove up me. I've had the undercarriage shred at my face. I've had a couple dozen surgeries putting this side of my face back together. It put my heart to the left. My lungs were collapsed. My ribs went through my lungs. I'm on the highway. I don't know what's happened, but I can't breathe. And I'm scared. Probably like my grandma was. You know, if you think about it, we're afraid to change home groups. Of course we're afraid of the big adventure. And I got so scared in a way that I never had, because when your lungs are collapsed, you can't breathe, and you know you're dying. And so what are you going to do? Finally, I just let go in the most absolute way, and I had the amazing experience of being wrapped in God's arms. All I felt were white, billowy clouds of love, nothing else. And obviously, I live, but not without a tremendous amount of consequence. I have a traumatic brain injury. I have an incomplete spinal cord injury. There's a lot of things wrong. And there are a lot of things that continue to be wrong, even though that was so long ago. But I get out and I lose everything I own. I wind up on food stamps and Social Security disability at 12 years sober. So where is my value going to come from? I can't remember your name 10 minutes after I meet you. You know, I don't have the ability to make any money anymore. Luckily, I was in the middle of AA, and I will share this with you. You guys took care of me. I didn't have family to come took care of me. AA took care of me. AA brought my meals. AA took me to my appointments. I was having seizures. I couldn't drive. I couldn't do anything. You guys took care of me. You loved me better. So you brought me new girls. He brought me new girls that were feeling sorry for himself. And you say, tell Cindy what you told us in the car on the way over. That new girl take one look at me looking like this, and she'd say, A little coaching, she'd finally say, well, when my boyfriend left and I don't know how I'm going to go on, I would have a seizure, and she would feel better. And that went on a lot. So what was my part in that? What did I do? I let it be enough. I let it be enough. I let God using me to have a seizure, to give a new girl perspective, be enough to give my life value. And when I feel value, which the only way I ever really feel value is when I am helping you, it is when I am thinking about you. And when I feel value and I feel like I can make a difference in your life, then it makes my life worth living. And through that, I began to get better. I had 6 years that were like very challenging years. I had the wreck. I still was having surgeries from the wreck, and I got stage 3 breast cancer. I was 34 when I was the wreck. I was 36 when I got cancer. I spent the better part of a year doing chemo and radiation. I'd been kicked through doors when I was a kid. My back had been broke, and the accident exacerbated and pushed my spine forward. So they had to go in and cut part of my spinal canal, literally, to keep it from stretching my spinal cord and to straighten up and make my back secure. That triggered a whole bunch of trauma memories. And so those of us in sobriety, most of us, whether it was drinking or whether it was before drinking, most of us have some trauma in our backgrounds. And eventually we got to face it all. And eventually we got to let it all go if we hope to stay sober. And so for me, that back thing, and there's been a gift in every single trauma that's ever happened to me. what happened for me is I was able to go through a long process with my sponsor when I got out of the hospital from that to put me in a place of forgiveness. And forgiveness is not rewriting history. It's taking the hook out of my mouth, you know, so that I am no longer hooked to the things that have happened to me. And then for the grand finale at the end of that 6 years when I was 40, I started a business after chemo. I had $1,700 to my name. I was recipient of the Traumatic Brain Injury Trust Fund. That lady from the Traumatic Brain Injury Trust Fund encouraged me instead of saying, what are you thinking? She said, if you need help organizing there, let me know, because that's what she did for me at home. That business today does business multinationally, and I can't do anything it does. So then, after the business started barely going, I didn't take a check for several years. I fell through my attic showing a contractor and broke my C5 vertebrae and was paralyzed from the chest down. I spent 3 months in the hospital here. So in that 6 years, I had to learn to walk again 3 times. When I was paralyzed, I didn't know that if I wanted to get up, I was tired. But it had shown up for me every single time. You guys had made my meals. You had taken care of me. You had loved me. And so I got up because you wanted me to. And I'm so blessed. Who gets to go through all that and stay alive? Who gets to go through all that and still have a life? I do. I do. Because of you. And all those things, one of the things they did for me, see, this is what sobriety gives me. It gives me a chance to see the gift in everything, no matter how bad it seems at first. Because, you know, what that gave for me is it peeled enough of that hardness away from me that the streets had given me. It just shredded it to where I could really love and I could feel your love. And I do. I did not get to Alcoholics Anonymous with the ability to love. I had lost that. I was not a whole human being. That put me back together pretty whole. I have had the most amazing life. I have stuff now. But what I've learned, and the only reason I say that at all, is that I know that stuff doesn't make you happy. And I know that there's no real value in it. And I know what it's like to lose it all sober and be happy. And I know what it's like to have things and feel in bondage by them. And sometimes they can become like a burden. And I think that God let me have stuff so I could just say that it doesn't make us any happier. It doesn't, you know, that it just doesn't. And I've been with and without it full sober. About 10 years ago, my brother was murdered. You know, I told you that they didn't fare as well as me. And it broke my heart a million ways to Sunday. But when I first got sober, my cousin died, who was my favorite cousin. Her husband grabbed onto me because he thought I was the only one that would understand how he felt, and I felt nothing. I looked at her in a casket, and I tried to feel something, but I felt nothing. My brother was murdered. I cried every day for at least a year. I hurt so much. It was so wonderful. Because I have regained my entire library of feelings. I miss my brother. I love him. I had to learn how to let him go and to know that he is okay and however he needs to be. I had to learn to forgive the man that shot him dead when he was unarmed. And I have. And I pray for that man. And I pray for the neighborhood he grew up in. My other brother, he's been in and out of the program as long as I've been in. He called me about 9 months ago. He was taking baths in the park. He knows that every time he calls me, I show up. Every time I don't judge him. Every time he tries to get sober, I just say, how can I help? Because I'm a sister, and that's my job. And I just love him. And so anyway, he's on parole, so I couldn't take him out of the state, but I have a girl that I used to sponsor, and I took him to a treatment program, and he's actually just got into a halfway house about a mile from my house, and he told me he'll be back on the 17th, which is my birthday. I said, well, happy birthday to me, little bro. My siblings call me mom and sister, because if you grew up the way that I grew up, you know, there's trauma, and you band together, and you protect each other, and I learned a lot of things I've had to unlearn sober. I've had to learn how to not be protected, how to just be myself, how to trust that God's going to take care of me no matter what, how to love you, how to show up, how to participate, how to be right here, right now. in COVID, I've had some real gifts that have come out of this, and I know that this is the difference in this and everything else I've been through in my life is we're all in this together. There's none of us that aren't going through it at the same time. There are none of us that are unaffected. So we can talk to each other. Learning how to do meetings like this, I feel really very dumb sometimes talking to myself in a little box with you in little boxes around me is not quite the same. But how lucky are we that we have this, you know? I'm health compromised. You know, I've never stopped having surgeries all these years. That's my life, and that's okay. But I'm not going to, like, put myself in a position where I'm likely to get COVID if I can avoid it. So it's been a little lonelier, and it's been a little more isolated. So I've taken up native flute, and I play guitar, but now I'm taught myself how to play classical guitar, and I do that in a form of meditation to connect with God. And that's what you guys have given me. How can I make something good out of anything? You know, we're the ones, our terrible past, they're the best thing about us. They're what let us help each other. And I think that it's the same with this. It's the same with everything. If I'm willing to look for the little gift from God and anything I've been through, I'll get to find it. And I'm always going to be okay as long as I'm connected with that power greater than me and with you. That's all I've got. Thanks for having me.